Welcome to Post Carbon Radio. We cover the climate crisis from a range of perspectives centered on Northern California. Climate change is the ultimate interrelated issue, so we include news and perspectives on clean and dirty energy, the economy, social justice, and even war and peace. We want to both inform and inspire you by connecting you to people, movements, and new ideas about climate change from around the world and right here in West Marin. Join us on KWMR the second and fourth Mondays of every month at 1 p.m. for Post Carbon Radio.
Welcome to Post Carbon Radio. A recent Stanford study shows us it's not just lack of precipitation, but rising temperatures that are turning California's normal dry years into a sustained drought. As we close out another hot winter, California is entering its fourth year of drought, and the state has only a year of water supply in storage. Meanwhile, as we covered last fall, we're depleting groundwater, our only backup supply, like there's no tomorrow. But we don't seem to have a real plan past tomorrow, let alone the next few years, if the drought continues, which it has a good chance of doing. Legislation passed in 2014 to manage groundwater in California isn't scheduled to take full effect for almost 30 years, while right now, for at least the second year in a row, wells are running dry, farmers are getting zero federal water, and millions of acres of farmland are laying fallow. In 2015, water managers in the valley are no longer maintaining minimum flows to preserve individual famous species like the Delta smelt, but to prevent the collapse of river ecosystems as a whole.
On this week's Post Carbon Radio, we update you on the many dimensions of the California drought, what Governor Brown and lawmakers are planning for the emergency drought relief, and from the perspective of rivers, fish, and the people who love them and live off them, particularly in the uber-hot Central Valley. Are our charismatic sport fish turning into canaries in the coal mine? What can we do to cope now and prepare for the possibility of this drought continuing and worsening? Let's ask our guests. Today we're joined by two fact-digging, fish-loving writers, Tom Stokely, Water Policy Coordinator of the California Water Impact Network, or CWIN, and Tom served as past chairman and vice chairman of the California Advisory Committee on Salmon and Steelhead Trout since 1990, and he combines for CWIN his extensive water law and legislative experience with his passion for fishery and restoration goals. And we have Dan Bacher, independent environmental journalist and chief sniffer at fishsniffer.com. Maybe welcome to Post Carbon, Tom and Dan.
Thanks very much, Bing. It's great to be on your show.
I thought we'd maybe start off with Dan. You've written extensively on the California drought, especially on the Delta smelt and the American River steelhead run.
Yes. Yes. First of all, I'm the editor of the Fish Sniffer magazine, which is out of Northern California publications in Citrus Heights, California. And I also write for a number of other publications ranging from Counterpunch to Truth Out to the Daily Cause. And I've also worked for a number of years on trying to restore fish to our rivers and delta. One fishery that's very close to my heart is American River steelhead. And this year, the American River's Nimbus Fish Hatchery has trapped only 143 adult steelhead to date, according to the hatchery manager, Gary Novak. And this compares to a total of last year of 546 adult steelhead. In good years, there would be thousands, up to 4,000 fish. And big numbers of fish have come up the river in relatively recent years. 2011, 2012, and 2013 saw very good runs. So the collapse of this fishery has occurred over the last couple years, and myself and other anglers and environmentalists attribute this to the fact that during the 2013 drought year, the federal and state government exported vast quantities of water to Southern California Water Agencies, the Westlands Water District, and Kern County corporate agribusiness interests, as well as to oil companies in Kern County. And as a result, Folsom Reservoir was drained down to only 17% capacity, which is lower than it was in the 1976-77 drought. This resulted in the elimination of what we call the cold water pool in the reservoir that provides cold water for steelhead to survive through the summer, since the fish in the American River, the steelhead, they rear for a year in fresh water, and they need cold, clear, oxygenated water. Well, they didn't get it, and the consequence of that, plus the continued operation of the Delta pumps that sucks up a lot of the American River steelhead, resulted in a record low numbers. And this is really, really disheartening, except for, especially when I and other anglers and environmentalists worked for 25 years to restore this run, including pressuring the Bureau of Reclamation to release minimum flows, getting the hatchery modernized, and closing the river for 4 years during the spawning season so the fish could recover. And the fish were coming back, but the state and federal governments have thrown this down the drain. Now, at the same time, the Delta smelt is on the verge of an extinction. Just over the past couple of days, Peter Moyle of UC Davis, a renowned fish scientist and author of many books on ichthyology, disclosed that only 6 Delta smelt have been found in a survey that the Department of Fish and Wildlife did this year. Now, this follows up on a survey that was done last year where the index was 9, the lowest elevation population in history, and only 8 Delta smelt were captured at 100 of locations throughout the Delta estuary.
Dan, what do you mean by the index was 9?
That means it's a relative measure of abundance that they do by measuring the volume of water against the fish. And what that translates into in actual fish measured was only 8 fish. And that's like less than half of the previous low.
So it's kind of like the concentration of fish, and then you figure out how much water you have. And
right, that's the way the government does it. That's the way the scientists do it. They do relative measures of abundance in addition to actually counting the number of fish.
Let's bring Tom in on the conversation. Tom, can you tell us about the Central Valley salmon run?
Well, last year, because they ran out of cold water in Shasta Reservoir, the Bureau of Reclamation took it down too low. They killed about 95% of the juvenile and eggs and fry winter run Chinook salmon, which is listed under the Endangered Species Act. Also, most of the spring run Chinook spawning in the main stem Sacramento didn't survive. This is not where you see a large dead fish, but these are eggs that are laid in the gravel that don't hatch, or if they hatch out, the fish perish because the water's too warm, or in some cases they drop the flows and then the salmon nests were left high and dry.
So why should we be concerned about these statistics? I mean, not everybody eats Delta smelt or salmon.
Well, it's really the natural heritage of California. I suppose the grizzly bear being on our flag is indicative because it's extinct in California. But there are people who rely on the fall run Chinook salmon in the Sacramento River for sport and commercial fishing. It's really an iconic symbol of California, and it's part of our heritage. And we can save it if we make wise decisions about how we use our water.
So is it just symbolic and a small number of people who live off the fish, or is this really also symptomatic of a deeper problem or problems?
Yeah, it's a much more symptomatic of a deeper problem. The fact of the matter is that water in California is grossly over-allocated. There are water rights claims to over 5 times the amount of water than actually exists in a normal year. In a drought year like this, it's obviously much worse. And people have water contracts through the Federal Central Valley Project and the State Water Project, and they basically feel they're entitled to get 100% of their contract. But when they signed them, they knew that they could be cut to zero if there was a drought. And so it's this tug of war between giving people more and more water under their contracts that really doesn't exist and draining the reservoirs. And really one important thing about the fish is that if we have cold water in our reservoirs for fish, we also have cold water in our reservoirs for people. And once we drain our reservoirs down to what we call dead pool, which we're really starting to look at the possibility of that in a year like this or next year if the drought continues or the year after, we need to store some water. We need to keep it for the future, and we don't want to just give it all away. And in many cases, the water provided by the Federal Central Valley Project is very heavily subsidized by the taxpayers.
What does dead pool mean?
A dead pool means a reservoir is so low that basically the outlet works on the bottom of the dam is where the water's coming out, and there's basically only as much water going out as coming in. It's essentially an empty reservoir is what it is.
And why do we need cold water for people?
It improves water quality, better oxygen, less algae, and also just the larger the pool of cold water, then the more water there is for future years for people as well as the environment.
Next, I'd like to play a little short segment that I had with a watershed biologist, Preston Brown, who works on our local watershed, Lagunitas Creek. And I asked him what was the status of the local salmon run. Since you're working on our local watershed, Lagunitas Creek primarily, is that correct?
That's right.
Uh-huh. I was hoping you could give us a kind of a snapshot of what's happening with the salmon in our watershed. And what kind of salmon are they?
Well, these salmon are coho salmon, and they are a federally endangered species. So they're found in Lagunitas Creek, San Geronimo Creek, and Olema Creek, which are all part of the Lagunitas Creek watershed. And they have suffered a tremendous amount of habitat loss, habitat degradation, and their numbers are extremely low. And they've been told by a National Marine Fisheries Service group of scientists that they are on a downward extinction vortex, is what it's called. And it's not just Marin County where this is seen, it's throughout the whole North Coast. And the reason Marin County is so critical is because that's the last stronghold for the Central California Coast coho salmon, which are a unique species of coho salmon. So our efforts to bring these fish back to recovery have a lot of obstacles, and one is the threat of continued development in the Lagunitas Creek watershed, specifically the San Geronimo watershed. So our work focuses on habitat restoration, but also policy and trying to get the Marin County Board of Supervisors to enact a common sense, streamside protection ordinance that allows us to actually recover these fish without the threat of future development producing, increased water temperatures and decreased water quality for these fish.
And how is the drought impacting the salmon run?
Well, we've had serious droughts throughout the last several thousand years, and these fish have been able to flux and respond and recover from droughts. So, our efforts of habitat restoration and policy are really the last strong effort to really protect these fish. The drought will have minimal effects, but it's really the human impacts that are going to determine the fate of these fish.
What kind of work are you doing as far as habitat restoration exactly?
We are partnered with several private property owners in the San Geronimo Valley and public landowners such as the National Park Service to restore crucial floodplain habitat in the lower part of the watershed, but also stabilize banks, reduce erosion, improve habitat complexity for fish in the upper part of the watershed. We're currently working on a process right now to design full restoration of what's known as the Roy's Pool. It's located on San Geronimo Creek on the San Geronimo Golf Course. And the pools once acted as kind of a way for fish to bypass what was known as Roy's Dam, a small concrete dam on the creek. And unfortunately, now the Roy's Pools structures aren't functioning the way they were designed originally. So fish become stranded in the pools, and it's a migration barrier for adult fish and young fish. So we have, through work with design experts and engineers, designed a completely new channel that looks completely natural, organic, where fish can pass through from all life stages, from adults to fry any time of year. We're also coupling it with some critical backwater off-channel rearing habitat so young fish can grow up safely, and some floodplain enhancements.
Can you give me some statistics, like, and compared to previous years?
So the fish have basically, we're getting lower and lower returns year after year, with some slight upticks and downticks. But by and large, the population trend is diminishing year after year. So, you know, our efforts are absolutely critical in terms of getting these fish from the smallest stage of life to their adult stage of life. And, you know, a lot of our restoration efforts can help us do that. But what can undermine it all is having an option for increased development, unpermitted development on the creek. So, you know, we can restore floodplain habitat and we can restore fish passage barriers, but unless there's something in the books, a law that's going to prevent unpermitted development, then unfortunately the fish, the populations are likely going to continue just shrinking year after year.
And what numbers are we talking about, say, for instance, this last survey?
So this, the adult surveys are actually still in progress from this year, but I can speak to 2013, 2014, and we saw 220 adult salmon throughout the whole year. So that's the number of reds, so they're nests, 220 nests. Now, that is basically, it's below average for the last 15 years. And just to put it in perspective, the recovery goal set forth by the National Marine Fisheries Service is a goal of 1,300 reds in the watershed, and we've only seen 220. So we have a long way to go, and, you know, this recovery goal isn't planned to be met until 2120, but, you know, it's getting that population on a trajectory to approach that is the biggest effort we're trying to do now by getting large protections in place and common sense rules that can help get these fish back on the right trajectory.
And that was Preston Brown, a watershed biologist working with the Turtle Island Restoration Network. And now back to our interview with Dan Bacher and Tom Stokely.
Well, let's see. I know this is all connected with Brown's legacy, Twin Tunnels. You've both written and talked about this. Dan, do you want to talk a little bit about the Twin Tunnels?
Yes. The original plan that evolved into the Twin Tunnels was the Peripheral Canal. And this was a project that was developed in the 60s and in the 70s to transport water around the Delta. So, you know, it's supposed to help the Delta. Okay, that was the original idea by the Department of Fish and Game and by proponents of it. However, what it effectively does is you're taking the water out of the estuary by shipping it around, and it kind of defeats the purpose of an estuary, which is where you know, in other words, they're trying to re-engineer, replumb Mother Nature. And this has evolved in the recent years, started in 2007 under Schwarzenegger, into the Peripheral Tunnels. And this has been pushed through, or we also call them the Twin Tunnels. I like to call them the Death Tunnels. And
these are huge.
Yeah,
what
these are
the dimensions?
Yeah, they're 35 miles long, and I think it's 40 feet in diameter. It's a major undertaking, and it's probably the most environmentally destructive project in California history, because what the whole Twin Tunnels concept is based on the fact that you can somehow restore an estuary and a river system by taking more water out of it. And I've gone to legislators, I've gone to meetings and challenged the state and federal officials to show me one incidence in world or U.S. history where taking more water out of a estuary or river system has resulted in the restoration of the system. And all the scientific panels, ranging from the Delta Independent Science Board to the National Academy of Sciences, to the Environmental Protection Agency scientists, have real scathingly criticized the science of this plan and say that if you take this water out of the system, it may hasten the extinction of Central Valley salmon, steelhead, Delta smelt, longfin smelt, and a host of other species.
Dan, I thank you for bringing up the dimensions. I think some of us are better than others at imagining what that scale means. What I always think of is something that's 40 feet in diameter is big enough to float a house through.
Exactly.
And there are two tunnels, right? And they're going to be parallel?
Yes, they go on. One's the proposed tunnels are one's on the east side of the Delta and one's on the west side.
I understand that they're taking water directly north of Sacramento.
Yes.
Down in it. The price tag is $67 billion with a B. That's what I've heard.
Yeah, well, and Tom may be able to provide more information on that, but that figure came out of a meeting held by the Westlands Water District, who is one of the major water contractors, and an economist hired by them disclosed that when you consider all the costs involved, that it would cost $67 billion or more to complete this plan.
Yeah, that's correct. It was also reported in the San Jose Mercury News that with interest, the project would be up to $67 billion, and that would basically be the $25 billion that goes into the tunnels and the so-called habitat restoration, which we don't believe will work. I think the point of it is, though, too, if you look at the Bay Bridge and the problems with the rods there and the incredible cost overruns, that $67 billion figure is if the costs come within the existing cost estimates. They have very little geotechnical information. There are oil wells and pipelines all over the delta. We don't know what the geology's like. And I think it's very likely there'll be very significant cost overruns beyond what they anticipate. And I wouldn't be surprised if the project exceeded $100 billion.
Well, what is the status of it now? I know it doesn't need voter approval. It's going through some administrative process. Can you update us on?
Sure. They released a draft environmental impact statement and environmental impact report under the state and federal environmental laws. It went out to public comments last year. There were very significant negative comments. In particular, one from the U.S. EPA that basically said the project was not permittable and had major problems meeting water quality requirements. And so they've sent it back to the drawing board, and then supposedly sometime this spring or summer we're going to see a revised draft EIS, EIR out for public comment. We think what's really going on behind the scenes is that the proponents of the tunnels are basically trying to roll the EPA at the top levels in the Obama administration to basically back off and say that the project's fine.
So if this goes forward, who will benefit and who will be hurt by the twin tunnels?
Well, certainly Delta farmers will be hurt because of problems with saltwater fisheries, as we've discussed. Also, Northern California water interests. There's really no more water that it's going to produce. From our review of it, it really looks like they're actually going to use it as an opportunity to export the groundwater from the Sacramento Valley. There's a very large aquifer called the Tuscan Aquifer up there that is around Chico and goes out to the center of the valley. And we believe they'll probably drain that. And if you imagine the Tuscan Aquifer like a swimming pool with the kiddie pool on the east side where you have cities such as Chico and other cities that get their water from wells as well as sustainable farmers and walnut and almond growers, and they will see their water supply dry up. We'll see the streams in the that feed into the Sacramento Valley from the Sierra, we'll see them dry up and their salmon populations will die. What we'll probably see is that the agricultural interests such as Kern County Water Agency under the State Water Project or Westlands Water Project or Westlands Water District under the Central Valley Project, that they would benefit from it. Urban Southern California might get some additional water, but it really looks like the urban Southern California population will essentially be footing the lion's share of the bill, and they'll get some additional water, but really not very much for how much they'll be spending. And a lot of the benefits will accrue to agricultural interests.
And if we had some proponents of the twin tunnels, what would they say about who's going to benefit?
They would say everybody south of the delta would benefit because they'll have an increasingly reliable water supply that will be protected from earthquakes and other disruptions of the water supply from saltwater intrusion that might make levees dissolve. But the reality is that they could easily improve the existing levee system in the delta for a fraction of what they're talking about here, and that would actually protect their water supply equally, if not better. Also, the BDCP, of course, fails to address the fact that the California Aqueduct parallels the San Andreas Fault and crosses many faults on its way south to Southern California, and they haven't addressed that earthquake hazard either. I would certainly say that given the fact that we don't have unlimited money here in California, the best possible investment for urban Southern California is to invest in things that reduce their reliance on imported water from the State Water Project or the Colorado River, recycling, conservation, stormwater capture. Those are all local projects that will produce water fairly reliably on an annual basis. They'll provide local jobs and reduce dependence on these aqueducts that are very vulnerable to earthquakes and other problems.
Yeah, one thing I'd like to add is that a big thing you need to consider in this whole plan is it being Jerry Brown's personal legacy. I went to a press conference in 2012, probably the largest press conference ever held by the governor. There was at least 100 people there in a room at the Resources Agency. And he essentially got very combative with the reporters, very defensive, and said, you know, we're going to build it. We'll do the studies, but we have to build it. We have to do it. So he very much indicated, regardless of the logic of it, regardless of the science, regardless of the economics, he wanted to build this for his own personal legacy. And that's really disturbing, because when you look at the science, when you look at the economics, and when you look at the logic of the whole thing, it doesn't make any sense. So, you know, it definitely needs to be taken into consideration, this being a legacy project. And at the same time, it appears to me in many cases that with all the criticism by federal agencies, including the EPA, that the Obama administration isn't as fervent in building this project as Brown is.
So, Tom, you talked about how the proponents would say that Southern California would get a more reliable water source, and you talked about some alternatives to that in terms of building more local recycled and other forms of local water. What about alternative solutions for the Central Valley farmers?
Yeah, you know, there are over 1 million acres of farmland in the western San Joaquin Valley, Tulare Basin, down in Kern County as well, that are what we call poison land. This is land that's an old ocean bed that when the ocean dried up, the minerals concentrated in the soil, and they have, in some cases, very high levels of selenium, salt, boron, arsenic, molybdenum, and a number of toxic substances that are actually mobilized from the irrigation of those lands, which then causes pollution to groundwater, and in some cases surface water, and they also create wildlife hazards. Our solution to that is to retire this poison land. It simply doesn't make sense to take California's limited water supply and put it on ground that's a poison, and especially if we're growing things like almonds to export to China. We really have better uses of our water, and that's a big part of the paper water problem, is that these water districts down there are promised much more water than can possibly be made available, and we need to end the expectation of unlimited water supplies.
I read somewhere about the almond trees taking requiring a tremendous amount of water. I think I read, I don't know what the statistic is, but I think Dan, did you have?
Actually, Tom has the information on that. According to our calculations, almonds use about 3.5 million acre feet of water per year, which is 10% of the entire agricultural water usage in California, and 8% of the total developed water supply, meaning the water that people consume. So almonds use more than all of the indoor residential water usage in California. They also use more water than all of the residential landscaping in California. And while we certainly believe that urban conservation is vitally important locally and statewide, one of the concerns that we have is that there's all this talk about a drought response, and we have the governor and the legislature introducing this drought legislation. I haven't had a chance to review it yet, but my guess is it probably does not contain a provision that would prohibit the planting of permanent crops in areas that don't have reliable water supply and or are also in areas of groundwater overdraft. I think a lot of people in the urban areas feel kind of like they're conserving for nothing. You know, they say, well, why should I conserve water when they're planting, 20,000 acres of almonds plus, pistachios and grapes and other things, and these people have all these legislators that want to give them more water for their crops, but really they knew when they planted those crops that their water could be cut to zero. They knew that the groundwater was in overdraft and the groundwater levels were declining. So why should the public at large pay for bad business decisions by, you know, almond hedge fund managers. And I think that's an issue that really needs to be addressed in the current debate.
And what about cotton? I understand that's a water-intensive crop.
Well, it is, but it's not a permanent crop. And I believe almonds use more water than cotton. Dan could correct me if I'm wrong. And the thing about cotton is that while it's, you know, heavily subsidized, at least when there isn't any water, you don't have to water it. You don't have to plant it. In the case of almonds and pistachios and grapes and other permanent crops, it's what we call hardening the demand for water. They can't go a year without water. And so some of these almond farmers, such as Paramount Farms down in Kern County, you know, they're willing to pay top dollar for water. And I'm concerned that as the drought proceeds, that we could see almond farmers outbidding the cities for water. And then where does that leave us?
So it sounds to me like, you know, assuming the drought continues, maybe not every year the way it's been the last 4 years, but that our long-term trajectory is for a drier and hotter California. If that proves to be true over the next, say, 10 years, then it sounds to me like we're going to have to make these decisions anyway about taking some land out of cultivation or changing the crops that are grown, you know, for lower demand, lower water crops and higher sort of food value, maybe less cash value. Do you think that's correct, that these are probably inevitable decisions and it's just a question of when we're going to have to face them?
Well, I think probably in the very long run, but in the short run, what we're seeing is a weakening of environmental standards, a hardening of positions in terms of who's entitled to what water. And what I see is, yes, perhaps in the long run, this land will be taken out of production, although the way we see it is many of these water districts are actually trying to firm up their access to water. For instance, Westlands Water District has a longstanding lawsuit against the federal government to provide drainage service because of these problems with selenium and salt. And the agreement would actually give Westlands, instead of an interim water contract, it would give them a permanent water contract. And it has to be approved by Congress. And given the makeup of the current Congress, I wouldn't be surprised if Congress actually gave them a better deal and gave them a more, quote, reliable water supply that, for instance, in a year like this, they would be getting several hundred thousand acre-feet of water, whereas they're getting none. And that actually will exacerbate and worsen the current situation that we're in with the drought. So whatever makes common sense to you or me as a human being, as a citizen, has virtually no necessarily no effect on the politics in Washington or Sacramento, because we don't have the ear of legislators. We don't have access to people like that.
So tell us, for those of for our listeners who are not in the Valley, where is the Westlands Water District? What's grown there, and who's growing there?
Westlands Water District is a 600,000 acre water district that's west of Fresno. To the south, at the very south end, is Kettleman City. Near the north end is Mendota, although that's not within Westlands. The there's an Air Force base there. I don't know if you remember the name, Dan. But anyway, they traditionally have grown a lot of annual crops, garlic and you know, corn and melons and. But with, you know, the economics of almonds and pistachios, they've switched more and more to these permanent crops, which require quite a bit more water, and again, require water in a dry year when they don't get any water from the Federal Central Valley Project. So they're a very, very powerful water agency. They have the ear of a lot of legislators. They apparently make a lot of money because they're able to hire the best lobbyists, the best attorneys. The water from Westlands actually originally came from the Trinity River way up in northwestern California, the largest tributary of the Klamath River. And Westlands is very heavily subsidized. The Environmental Working Group has done a number of reports on them, and they get water subsidies, in some cases crop subsidies, if they do grow things like cotton or rice. And they also get power at a very inexpensive rate. And there's this long-term drainage problem there. where a lot of the land is salting up because it has high salty groundwater and the crops die. And because of that, the federal government had an obligation under a 1960 act to provide them with drainage service, and they have not solved the problem. And so now there's a proposed settlement between the government and Westlands that would essentially forgive them over $300 million in debt, give them a permanent water contract, and not require the retirement of any additional land. So we think it's a bad deal, but the public really doesn't have any say over it. It'll go to a judge, and then it'll go to Congress. So they're kind of the big bad player on the block in terms of California water. I don't know if you want to add anything else, Dan.
The key issue here to understand is the domination of California politics, both the Democratic and Republican parties, by big money, big corporate agribusiness money. And that was evidenced in the Proposition 1 campaign, where every corporate interest, ranging from the timber industry to corporate agribusiness to the oil industry to various large labor unions, put money into the campaign. Agribusiness itself spent over $850,000, including $150,000 from Stuart Resnick, who is the owner of Paramount Farms in Kern County and is the largest orchard fruit grower in the world. And he and his wife, Linda, own a number of businesses, including Teleflora, and they own Fiji Water, they own Palm Wonderful, Wonderful Pistachios, and a bunch of different companies. But they are very tight with Senator Dianne Feinstein, Jerry Brown, and the legislature and Congress, and they contribute to both parties. It was real interesting in the election of 2008. I reviewed their records, and they contributed, I think it was $22,000 to the Obama campaign, and then they put another $20,000 to his opponent. And they contribute to the Democratic National Committee. They contribute to the Republican committees. And so they hedge their bets so that no matter who's in charge, who's in political office, they have their person in there. And this is the same with Westlands Water District. For instance, there was a big story several years ago about, and it was in a lot of the mainstream media, about a fundraiser that Dianne Feinstein held for, or Westlands held for her. So this goes back to the same thing, the same ill that we confront in all the problems of our society, which is the merger of big government and big corporations has produced what may be the extinction of Delta smelt and the collapse of salmon, steelhead, other species. And this is one thing I really want to make clear here, is this isn't farmers versus fish. This is family farmers, environmentalists, fishermen, traditional tribal people, and the public trust and the people of California versus big corporate agribusiness, oil companies, and other corporate interests. That's the battle. It's you know, big money versus the public trust and the people.
I think that's helpful for us in Northern California because we sort of know about that, but we don't see it at the same scale that you do in the Valley. So that's a helpful characterization.
Thank you.
Jing, do you want to jump in?
Yes. I know, Dan, you also written about fracking, and how much water does fracking take away from our systems?
Okay. In terms of the comparison with corporate agribusiness and Southern California water agencies, the oil industry takes a lot less. A bunch of people have done various estimates. Okay, there's a lot of numbers out there, but nobody really knows how much water is used by the oil industry or fracking. However, my calculations is that traditionally over the years, and this was based on an article, a very good researched article in Orion magazine that that relied on state and federal statistics, that it comes out to about 160,000 that's used right now per year. We don't really know how much will be used if is fracking is expanded as it appears to be in California. But one thing you got to consider.
160,000 acre feet?
Pardon?
160,000 acre feet?
Yeah, that's approximately, but you see, that's very approximate, and it's like, for instance, the Richard Stapler, I think it was, from the California Department of Water Resources, he said their records say that only 8 acre feet, which is just ridiculous, was used. This was several years ago. And then even the oil industry person, Catherine Ruiz Boyd, the president of the Oil Association of the Western States Petroleum Association, admitted that it was a lot more than that. It was in the hundreds of acre feet, but actually it's thousands of acre feet. And that's one of the problem with California politics is that oil industry even exceeds corporate agribusiness in its control over the state, over politics. Just last year, the Western States Petroleum Association alone spent $8.9 million on lobbying legislators and state officials. That was twice its previous record. And so they're using, they basically control the process. They own the politicians. And like Jerry Brown, he's gotten well over $2 million from oil industry interests that have either gone to found to behest of his or actually directly going into campaigns. Robert Gammon from the East Bay Express, he figured out, I think it was around $2.4 million, but it's expanded a lot. The money that's gone to Jerry Brown alone since the election. Just so you know, the big oil companies are always the big contributors to Brown. Occidental and Era Energy, they contributed over $250,000 to his Proposition 1 and 2 campaign. So what we face here is that, you know, the legislature, and the administration, the Brown administration, are effectively tools of both corporate agribusiness and the oil companies.
Remind the listeners what Props 1 and 2 were.
Prop 1 was the water bill, and Prop 2 was the rainy day fund. Maybe Tom can talk a little bit more about exactly what they did.
Well, rainy day fund, I believe, was to set aside some money for when the economy goes sour. We didn't take any position on that, but Proposition 1 was a water bond. It was about a $7.5 million bond. It was pared down from a 2009 bond that the legislature approved for the ballot in 2009, but it never made it to the ballot because of the economy. It would provide $2.7 billion for new storage projects and varying amounts of water for other things such as levees and recycling and conservation and also water for disadvantaged communities in the Central Valley, which, of course, is very important for a lot of folks who don't have any water right now, although we felt that could have been covered in a much smaller bond act. We did not support the bond act because we felt there was too much of an emphasis on storage in it and not nearly enough of an emphasis on recycling and conservation and all those things.
Well, it seems like Governor Brown and legislators were going to unveil their emergency drought relief plan. We don't know what the details are yet, but since we have to wrap it up, I'd like to give you both a chance to give us your solutions. Do you think we should start water rationing right now? And given the situation with the groundwater pumping that fossil fuel water that takes, what, thousands of years to replace, what should we be doing?
Well, the first thing we should be doing is banning the planting of permanent crops in areas of groundwater overdraft and or interruptible water supplies such as the Federal Central Valley Project. It just doesn't make any sense to be planting permanent crops that are going to demand more of our water in the future when we're running out of what we have. At some point, it may get down to providing water to people in the cities versus agriculture. It hasn't gotten that far yet. The second thing would be to retire these poison lands in the western San Joaquin Valley, Tulare Basin, and Kern County that cause pollution to irrigate. That would free up a tremendous amount of water and also take care of a huge pollution problem, and actually in some cases might even reduce water subsidies. And then obviously recycling, conservation, stormwater capture for urban areas. Many of the cities in Southern California have plans to reduce their reliance on imported water. Long Beach is a really good example, and even I believe Los Angeles is moving in that direction. So those are certainly the long-term solutions, and obviously the short-term solutions are to conserve water as much as we can. I know I'm capping off the sprinklers on my lawn, and we'll be letting it die, as I'm sure many millions of Californians will be doing this year.
Yes, and I'd like to basically support Tom on all his solutions. I'd add a couple things. The first is immediate ban on fracking, because one thing I didn't point out yet was that there's been a number of studies lately that reveal that many fracking wells in the San Joaquin Valley have contaminated groundwater supplies. This is already happening. And so here they are. They're taking water and they're returning it back as polluted water in an area that already has immense problems with groundwater contamination and with all the selenium and other toxic minerals that come from drainage-impaired land on the west side of the San Joaquin Valley. So we need to ban fracking. We can't spare a drop of water during a drought to frack California. Secondly, we need to support the Environmental Water Caucus's responsible export plans. That includes a lot of what Tom was talking about. Particularly what it does, it sets a cap on water exports annually to 3 million acre feet. And it's a very detailed plan. It has all sorts of innovative solutions, including water recycling and conservation. And this plan that is one that the state of California refuses to look at. And it's very viable. It provides a solution that would restore salmon, steelhead, smelt, and other species, and at the same time would provide for farmers and for all of our urban water needs.
And where can listeners find out more about the Environmental Water Caucus?
If you go up to Environmental Water Caucus.
It's EWCCalifornia.org.
Okay.
EWC, standing for Environmental Water Caucus, so EWCCalifornia.org. Yeah, okay. And it's called the Responsible Exports Plan.
Right.
And what do we mean by exports? To whom?
That would be exports out of the Delta from Northern California.
Okay.
Thank you, gentlemen. We've covered a lot of material today, and thank you for your time joining us, and let's stay in touch.
Thank you so much for having us.
Before you hang up, can you both, Dan and Tom, do you want to list any websites for listeners to look further into your own research and these issues?
Yeah, that would be great. The California Water Impact Network, which is known as CWIN, our website is www.c-win.org. And we have news clippings there. We have a search engine. We have lots of information at the top of our page about various aspects of water. If anybody has any questions or needs any more information, you can send an email to info@c-win.org.
Great. And Dan?
I would recommend going to that website as well as to the EWC.org website that Tom already mentioned.
Okay, great. Well, thanks again, gentlemen.
Thank you very much. You have a great day.
And thank
All
you.
Right.
Have a good one.
I'm trying to spread the word about this immense issue, but I find it absurd why so many people are confused. Some people don't understand the weight of this problem. Act now before it gets out of hand, cause Earth is calling. I was 10 years old, exposed to it. The inconvenient truth really made me concerned how it was going to affect the youth. The temp is still rising from the pollution we produce. We need to start striving for a solution to reduce. When we burn fossil fuels like coal and gasoline, we're using dirty energies when we should be using clean. When we burn, we're adding to the greenhouse effect. CO2, CH4, and N2O collect in our atmosphere. They remain up there for years and years, absorbing sun rays that come near. But we need to persevere, cause this makes our planet's temp rise fast. So why can't we find a way to cut back on our greenhouse gas?
We have waited too long. Act now before the moment's gone. The situation's tough, but stay strong until
we see the dawn.
The climate's on my mind, the climate's on my mind.
The most abundant greenhouse gas is carbon dioxide, beats of methane, nitrous oxide, and the F gases by landslide. Everyone releases it when they drive, unless you have an electric ride. It's almost 400 parts per million, and the main reason for climate's rise. Deforestation makes it worse when the trees decay. CO2 dispersed, also dead trees can't breathe it in. Makes it hard to cut back our emissions. Temperature is on the rise, all other animals can blame us, because we are where the fault lies, and it's coming back to maim us. Rising climate poses many problems to the human race. Extreme weather like Katrina and Haiyan, we'll have to embrace. The glaciers are melting, and the sea level's rising at a fast pace. People living on the coast are going to be displaced. Certain species extinct, less water to drink. Other areas too wet, floods a big threat. Other areas dry out, susceptible to drought. Agriculture hit hard, coral reefs will be marred.
We have waited too long, act now. Situation's tough, but stay strong until
we see the dawn.
The climate's on my mind, the climate's on my mind. The climate's on my mind, the climate's on my mind. The climate's on my mind, the climate's on my mind. The climate's on my mind, the climate's on my mind.
Solar, wind, hydro, geothermal is the key. Those are kinds of renewable energy that we need to succeed and implement. Cause climate change is extremely significant. If you don't believe me, read the news. The IPCC, not the Heartland Institute. The stakes are so high, we can't afford to lose. Our planet's like a stick of dynamite, and we've already lit the fuse.
We have waited too long, act now, before the moment's gone. The situation's tough, but stay strong until
we see the dawn.
The climate's on my mind, the climate's on my mind. The climate's on my mind, the climate's on my mind.